Possible in part by a grant from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 8,000 food items from Europe, South America, the Middle East, and the Orient. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning in the first hour of the show, we'll be going to the Focus 580 archive, so that means we won't be taking calls. I do just want to remind you again, though, we'll be back in our more regular form in hour number two, and we will be expecting calls, or at least we will be welcoming calls, and this will be the show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. We do it every other month, and the guest will be Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana, so that will be in hour number two. In this first hour, a program from the Focus Archives all about the California Gold Rush. This show first aired December 17th. Conversation with historian H.W. Brands, talking about his book, The Age of Gold, a book that just last year came out in paper. So again, remember, this is an archive program and we won't be taking your calls. In this part of Focus 580, we will talk about some of the history of the California Gold Rush, an event that our guest this morning, historian H.W. Brands, says is one of those major things, major turning points in history where, in his phrase, you mark the period before and the period after. And it's something that not only changed this country and changed the way Americans think about their destinies, it really changed the world. He's written about this in a book that's now out in paperback. It's titled The Age of Gold, The California Gold Rush and the New American Dream. It's published by Anchor Books. If you're interested, you can seek out the book. Our guest, H.W. Brands, is a distinguished professor of history at Texas A&M University. He has authored 17 books, among them a biography of Benjamin Franklin. That's titled The First American. That was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. He's also done a biography of Teddy Roosevelt. That book is T.R. The Last Romantic, and he's also written a lot about American politics. Another of his recent books is titled The Strange Death of American Liberalism, and there are a number of others. As we talk, questions, comments are certainly welcome. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and dial the number if you'd like to be part of the conversation. The number in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, is 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. If you have questions here at any point, just the only thing we ask is people are brief, so we can get in as many as possible. But anyone's welcome to call 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Brands, hello.
Morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I really appreciate it. And, you know, I think we talked before. I believe that we talked about the devil we knew.
That's right.
So that would have been 10 years ago, I guess.
Gosh, that long.
In 1993. Well,
yeah.
At any rate, thanks very much for being with us this morning. We certainly appreciate it. And I think it's certainly very striking, just to start out, the things that you say about the Gold Rush and just how important an event it was, not just for the United States, but also for the world. And I do like that phrase about how, you know, there are some points in history where you talk about before and after, and you think that the Gold Rush is one of those places.
Well, I do, and in fact, one of the things that makes it so striking is that the discovery of gold in California was utterly unexpected. No one in California was looking for gold. When James Marshall essentially tripped upon the gold at the mill that he was building for John Sutter, he had no idea that he was looking for gold, and when he found it, he had no idea, at least at first, the change that it would affect on California, on the United States, and on the rest of the world. So there, sometimes, you know, at the end of a war, you can say that the world is different before the war and after the war. But that's the sort of thing that people kind of see coming from a distance. But in the case of the discovery of gold in California, this was utterly an accident, and it really did change the world. It caused, in the very short term, 300,000 people to travel to California from literally all over the world. They all went there looking to make their fortune. Now, a lot of them didn't make their fortune, but their lives were changed in the process, and the course of American history, and to some extent, the course of world history was changed in the process. So I really think it's not that much of an overstatement. That's not an overstatement at all to say that the The world before the discovery of gold in California was really quite different from the world after the discovery of gold.
Yeah. What was California like at this time?
It was the sleepiest place you could imagine, and it was about as far as anyone could be from, say, the settled parts of the eastern United States. One of the remarkable things about the California gold rush is that we often think of it as a chapter in American history. But in a very large way, Americans were the last ones to arrive in California for the reason that to get from, let's say, New York to San Francisco in 1848 or 1849, by the way that people would normally travel, that is, by ship, you had to go clear around South America and up the west coast of South America to California. That distance was approximately 16,000 nautical miles, which is two-thirds the distance around the entire planet Earth. It was easier and faster to get from New York to India than it was from New York to California. And for that reason, the first arrivals in California were people from all around the Pacific Basin, from the west coast of Mexico, from Chile and Peru, from the Hawaiian Islands, from Australia, from China. And those folks all got there, by and large, before the Americans came. For that reason, California, in the early 1850s, was the most cosmopolitan place on the entire Earth.
That is really interesting that we think about this, as you say, as being an important chapter in American history, and think about the idea that as soon as the word got out, rush was the appropriate term, that is people rushed to try to get there. But it would have, as you say, and it would at the time, it would have been easier for someone to get there from Asia or from Australia or from Latin America than it would be for someone to get there from New York.
Well, in fact, one of the things that people sometimes have to readjust their thinking to keep in mind is that gold was discovered at the beginning of 1848, in January of 1848. And, of course, all the Americans who travel out to California are called 49ers. Well, the reason for this was that the news didn't make it back east to the eastern part of the United States until the autumn, and it wasn't officially announced until December of 1848. And even then, all those folks who were going to travel by land, which was ultimately the majority of them, they had to wait until spring, until the grass greened up on the prairies and in the plains so that they could make it across. And so gold was discovered in January of 1848. And the 49ers didn't arrive, by and large, until August or September of 1849. So there was a year and a half of delay in between, during which people came from all over the world. When I first started writing the book, I had known, of course, that there had been lots of good books about the California Gold Rush, written from the perspective of California history. And, of course, it's the founding period of modern California, and much springs from that. So it makes perfect sense that California historians would have taken it on. But one of the reasons that I wrote the book is that I had this sense that the California Gold Rush was underappreciated as an aspect of American history. And one of the things that I did when I was preparing to write the book was to look at several college-level American history textbooks to see what sort of coverage is accorded to the California Gold Rush. And I was a little bit surprised, not entirely, to discover that it got anywhere from a sentence to maybe a paragraph. And I thought this was quite odd, because this was, when you tally up all the people who came from all over the world, it was probably the largest mass movement of peoples since the Crusades of the 12th century, or thereabouts. And for it to be granted essentially footnote status in the main narratives of American history struck me as kind of odd. So I thought there must be more to it, and so I initially conceived the book as placing the California Gold Rush in the broader context of American history. But once I got to writing the book and once I got to doing the research, I realized that, in fact, I had been thinking even too small, that it really was a chapter in world history. I think if you want to, sometimes I do, you can look at the California Gold Rush as the first event in modern world history. Now, that might sound like a grand claim, but if you think of an event as something, a discrete event, so something that happens, you know, at a particular moment and that has almost instantaneously global ramifications, I think it'd be hard to find an earlier example than the California Gold Rush.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is historian H.W. Brands. He teaches at Texas A&M University at College Station. He's professor of history there and is author of this book that we're talking about. It's titled The Age of Gold, The California Gold Rush and the New American Dream. It's now out in paperback. It's published by Anchor Books. So if you're interested in history, you can seek out the book. And if you have questions, you can talk with the author. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. So we talked here about the fact that it was the journey overland or the journey by boat, if you were on the eastern seaboard of the United States, would be very difficult and would take a long time, and that it was easier to get here from Asia. What happened when the people from the eastern United States, from New York and places like that, finally got to California and realized that there were all these foreigners who had gotten there first, and that they had to get in line behind Asians and Australians and people from Latin America in this this business of trying to make their fortune?
Well, the first thing that happened, kind of surprisingly, was not much, because until probably the middle or end of 1849, there were still plenty of opportunities for people simply to go to the gold fields, and the gold fields actually consisted typically of river valleys, because most of the mining was done on stream beds or in stream beds when the river had been diverted. Most of the people were simply in too much of a hurry to stake their own claim, to bother about who was mining beside them. And so there was this odd mix. There were Mexicans and Chinese and Australians. There were Native American Indians. There were former slaves and, in fact, some continuing slaves, although slavery was technically illegal in California. Slaveholders brought their slaves anyway, and nobody really bothered them much. And so there were slaves and slave masters. There were rich folks and poor folks who were really mining right next to each other. And so at first, there was, simply because everybody was so interested in getting rich and getting their hands on the gold as quickly as they could, they paid very little attention to what was going on around them. But as the better claims were snatched up, then the American arrivals began to look askance at the foreigners. Because, and it was particularly galling in from their perspective, that among the first arrivals and among some of the most efficient miners were Mexicans. Now, of course, California had come into the possession of the United States as a result of the Mexican War. And so many Americans, including some veterans of the war, thought it rather odd that they had fought this war, and as a result of the war against Mexico, California had become a possession of the United States. And now Mexicans were busy taking all the gold out of California and taking it back to Mexico. So within a relatively short space of time, there developed certain animosities toward foreigners. It was including toward Mexicans, but also foreigners generally, because there was this feeling, and it's not entirely impossible to understand, that this was American soil, and therefore Americans ought to have first claim on the resources the soil held. And there were various attempts by the California legislature, after California got a state government, to pass taxes and other restrictions on foreign miners. But there were some problems making that stick, because within 2 years of the discovery of gold, as many people working in the mines were employees as they were individual entrepreneurs. The first arrivals just went in on their own, and with a wash pan and a washboard or a small long tom, basically a personal mining device, they could make money on their own. But after the initial claims were cleaned out, then people had to pool their resources. They had to go into bigger operations, and typically miners who arrived after about 1851 quite often went to work for somebody else. And for that reason, there were the miners could be grouped into two categories, the employers and the employees. And the employers, at this point, were quite happy to have foreign miners come in, including Chinese, especially Chinese, because the Chinese were willing to work for lower wages than the Americans. So there was always this tension. There were those people, there were those Americans who still wanted the claims to themselves, who tried to keep foreign miners out of the mining field, and there were those who were employers who wanted to allow the foreigners to come in. And so there was a tension throughout the 1850s between those people who wanted to keep the foreigners out and those people who wanted to bring them in. And it wasn't finally resolved in the case of, let's say, the Chinese, until the 1880s when Congress passed a law barring the immigration of most Chinese. For other immigrants, they were basically able to come as free as they wanted to. Yeah.
We have a caller, and I just want to tell people who are listening, and questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have someone here listening over near Danville in Belgium on our line 4. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to propose that, yes, there was even a greater rush to gold before this one, and that would be the colonization of America, because the Spanish ran to the New World with dreams of El Dorado and riches to the Far East, and it just pretty much populated the whole place. That seems to me to be the first rush for wealth and from the New World, to me. And also, it's interesting that it's still going on today, because we find it in, the rush to the dot-coms, the rush to one thing or another. Maybe it's not natural resources, but we always seem to run to uranium or diamonds or something that seems to have somebody thinking of wealth with little work involved.
Well, I think, Professor Brands, you make the argument that maybe that very idea, the last thing the caller said, was somehow... Maybe that's where it's rooted in the way that we think, and that one of the big changes here in America was that people changed how they thought about wealth and success and how you get those things.
Well, that's exactly right. I agree with the caller that the desire to discover gold was one of the principal motives behind getting the Spanish to the New World. I'll point out, though, that in order to have a gold rush, at least as it's understood in American history and, in fact, in other places around the world in the latter part of the 19th century, there has to be more than simply the desire for gold. There has to be the opportunity to go and get it yourself. And when the Spanish came over, they quickly monopolized the gold and silver mine. And so if you were an ordinary Spaniard in the 16th or 17th century, you weren't free simply to go to Mexico and start mining gold on your own. And so one of the things that makes the rush to California distinctive is that not only was there this large supply of gold essentially just lying on the ground, but it occurred on soil that nobody individually owned. In fact, if the gold had been discovered on private property, there never would have been a gold rush. If you went home, David, from work today and found gold in your backyard, there wouldn't be a gold rush to your backyard because you would own that resource. What made the gold rush in California was that there was all this gold, and secondly, it was on public property. It was property that had just passed to the control of the United States, and the American philosophy of public resources was they're there for the taking, not only by Americans, but by foreigners as well. And definitely regarding rushes for other things like the dot-com rush, one of the points I make in the book is that the gold rush to California changed American thinking regarding the nature of material success. It fostered what could be called a gold rush mentality. And so just 10 years after the discovery of gold in California, oil was discovered in western Pennsylvania. And people rushed to Pennsylvania in a way that they had rushed to California. In fact, many of the metaphors that were used in Pennsylvania came directly from the gold mines. People talked about a rush to Pennsylvania. They talked about black gold. And I won't say this might be the latest. It certainly won't be the last gold rush, was the rush to Silicon Valley in California in the 1980s and 1990s. And one of the points I make in the book is that I don't think it was an accident that this rush was to California, where this, call it again, the gold rush mentality, which I identify really as a willingness to take risks in pursuit of large material gain. This was something that really was foreign to Americans before the California Gold Rush. The model of success before the Gold Rush was the model of the Puritans, or the model of Benjamin Franklin's Poor Richard, where you work slowly, steadily, and over a long period of time, you build up a modest material wealth. You're not going to be really rich, but you'll have enough, and you might have a farm or a business you can hand off to your children. The California Gold Rush experience really overturned that notion by holding out the possibility that you could make a whole lot of money really fast. But what was required was a willingness to take risks. Risk was scary under the old Puritan model, because the Puritan model was based on the idea that material success connoted the state, a good state of your soul. And so if you succeeded, it meant that you were right with the Lord. If you failed, it meant there was something wrong with you. People went to California and discovered that that didn't have anything to do with success. Success was all about the willingness to take risk. It was also about luck. If you struck it rich in one place, that was great. If you didn't, you should go try again. And I think that one of the reasons that Silicon Valley emerged in California and not, say, around Boston, which in the 1960s and early 1970s had as many electronic firms as California, was that it was in California where people embraced this gold rush mentality most fully.
If I might make a point, sir.
Sure.
The people in Jamestown stayed away from work because they looked all over Virginia for gold.
That's right, and they didn't find any, so they had to go plant tobacco, and it's the only thing that saved them.
Well, a lot of them starved, too, sir.
Oh, and
the other point I might point out, sir, is that the original gold strike was on Colonel Sutter's property, and he lost most of it.
Well, actually, no, it wasn't on his property. Nobody owned the property. In fact, it was at the time James Marshall went up the river. This was in the middle of the Mexican War. So the property was, at that point, technically Mexican still. Mexico was about to lose the war to the United States, and it would pass to the United States. But nobody held property. Now, as soon as Marshall discovered gold, he went back down to Sutter's Fort to talk to Sutter. And Sutter tried to figure out how he could stake a claim to this property. But, in fact, he never was able to get the claim accepted by anybody, which was why he wasn't able to control the mine. In fact, he also lost most of the property that he did have title to around Sutter's Fort, which became Sacramento.
Thank you very much. Right.
And that is, you say, and as the caller says, that is one of the ironies about the gold rush, that if you know anything about it, you know the name Sutter, mm-hmm. and the association between Sutter and the discovery of gold. And this other man, it wasn't Sutter who discovered the gold. It was this man who Sutter had hired to build him a sawmill.
Right.
That, you know, if you would think anybody would have gotten rich, it would have been these two guys because they were the first in. But in fact, as you say, neither of them became rich. And in fact, what happened, the gold rush turned out to be something of a disaster for John Sutter.
It was a disaster for Sutter. And frankly, it was a disaster for just about everybody who had gotten used to life in California before the discovery of gold. One of the individuals that I feature in the book was a guy named Mariano Vallejo, who was the largest landholder in California under the Mexican government. He had tens of thousands of acres. But Vallejo, like Sutter, had, if you want to call it a business model, that was based on, first of all, the large availability of land and the small availability of labor. There were no people there to speak of. And time passed very slowly. Both of them were going to make their money off of cattle ranching. And the fact that no one was going to come in and try to steal their cattle or steal their land, they really didn't have much competition for what they were doing. And both Sutter and Vallejo had done very well under what you could call the old regime. But once gold was discovered, all of a sudden, California, which at the time of the gold discovery had fewer than probably 30,000 people, it was inundated with 300,000 people. And both Vallejo and Sutter found that the skills that they had developed, the skills that had served them very well under the older, slower, land-rich regime, failed in the face of this rush for riches. And both Vallejo and Sutter died poor.
Something else that also is interesting when you take a look at who it is that did make money, the real fortunes that were made by those people who were smart enough to know that the money was not to be made in actually going out and doing the mining. The money was there to be made in making money from the people who were going out and doing the mining.
With rare exceptions, that was true. Now, one of the rare exceptions was George Hearst. George Hearst was a miner in the Midwest who heard about gold in California and decided that mining gold was probably going to be more lucrative than mining lead in Missouri, and so off he went to California. George Hearst built up a fortune that lasted for quite a long time, and in fact, I just happened to be in South Dakota a few months ago where the Homestake gold mine recently closed after operations of 125 years. That was one of Hearst's mines. Hearst was one of those rare miners who made a lot of money. But the people who made the most durable fortunes were exactly as you say. Those people who realized that money was to be made not so much out of the mines, but out of the miners. In fact, this became quite apparent very early after the discovery of gold. There were two ways of thinking about what the discovery of gold meant. One was the way that was adopted by Sutter and his partner James Marshall. And that was to keep your mouth shut about this and try to monopolize as much of the resource as you can before people inevitably arrive. That's what Sutter and Marshall attempted, and it didn't work. It didn't work largely because the other way of thinking about it, one that was adopted by another individual who figures largely in my book, Samuel Brannan, was to spread the news as loudly and as quickly as possible in hopes of bringing lots of people to the gold fields, because these people are going to be your customers. Brannan had a general store at Sutter's Fort, and he didn't care so much about whether there was any gold in the ground. He just wanted a lot of people to come because these people were going to be his customers. So what he did was to get his hands on a jar full of gold from the American River where gold was discovered. And he went downstream to San Francisco, which at that time was a small village of about 500 people. And he began running around the streets of San Francisco yelling, "Gold! Gold on the American River!" And this got the news out around California. All of a sudden, people began flocking to Sutter's Fort, which was where Sam Brannan had his store, and Sam Brannan began making lots of money. He was California's first millionaire, and his example was followed by other merchant types, people like Leland Stanford, who had been a lawyer back in the East, but his law office burned down, so he went out to California, where several of his brothers had already gone and were operating grocery and general merchandise stores. And Stanford went in business with them at Sacramento and made a small fortune, which he then parlayed into a large fortune when he shifted from groceries to building railroads.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here. Let me introduce again our guest, and we have some other callers. We're talking this morning with H.W. Brands. He is Distinguished Professor of History at Texas A&M University at College Station. And he's authored a number of books about American history, including The First American, which is a biography of Benjamin Franklin, T.R. The Last Romantic, that's a biography of Teddy Roosevelt. He's also written about American politics, and just to name one other book, he is the author of The Strange Death of American Liberalism. He has also contributed articles to many publications, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, as well as the American Historical Review, the Journal of American History, the Political Science Quarterly, and others. He is the author of a book that looks at the history of the California Gold Rush. So if you're interested in exploring some of this history, you head on down to the bookstore or the library to look at it. It's out fairly recently now in paperback. The title of his book is The Age of Gold, The California Gold Rush and the New American Dream, and it's published here in paper by Anchor Books. We have a number of callers here. We can get in some more folks. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next in line is a caller in Charleston, line 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
David, let me compliment you. You have a fine, intelligent, keen mind. You brought up the very topic I wanted to about the merchants, the ones making the money at the gold fields.
Sure. Well, I the only reason I would know to bring it up is because of Mr. Brand, so I won't take too much credit for that.
No, that was great. But now I've got to shift attention a little bit. If you can explain how it was that Sutter and Marshall died penniless and were shut out of this. Was it their own incompetence, or were they somehow cheated out of the land that held the gold? Or,
well, in the case of Sutter, he wasn't so much cheated out of land as he simply was made to realize that he had been operating his ranch on land that he didn't actually own. This was quite comparable to the attitude of many cattle ranchers in the American West, even 20 or 30 or 40 years after this, where if you went to places like eastern Nevada or Wyoming, where there was a whole lot of land and not very many people, folks didn't pay too much attention to exactly where your property lines were. People could run their cattle on wherever, and nobody really bothered them much. And that was the case with Sutter in California before the gold rush. There was simply so much land and so few people that he was able to do more or less what he wanted with the land that was around.
Now, sounds like it's the fighting between farmers and ranchers was based on the same deal. That the ranchers,
to some extent, had all the
land.
Now, I should add that there were other people who actually did get cheated out of their land. I mentioned earlier Mariano Vallejo.
Sure.
He held good title to much of his land, but in fact, although the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, the one that transferred California from Mexico to the United States,
yes,
stipulated that the United States and the new state government of California would honor land titles that were conveyed under the Mexican government, in practice that often didn't happen. Some of it was, a small part of it was an honest misunderstanding regarding what constituted a legal title under Mexican law and what constituted a legal title under American law. But a lot of it was simply a way of cheating Vallejo and some other of the Mexican landowners out of their property.
Sure.
And so it was a case where there was this, an old regime gave way to a new regime, an old legal system gave way to a new legal system. In some cases, it's hard to really shed too many tears for John Sutter, who was something of a shady operator himself.
Uh-huh.
For those people who had good titles, Vallejo among them, they really did get a raw deal. No question about that.
But Sutter didn't try to file a claim on the land, or?
Oh, he did. In fact, but what he spent most of the last 10 years of his life doing was applying to the U.S. Congress for a pension. He thought that because gold had been discovered, well, as he put it, on his property, you know, it wasn't on his property, but because he had been instrumental in the discovery of gold, either the state of California or the government of the United States owed him something. And, in fact, he spent the last 10 years of his life trying to get Congress to vote him a pension so he could simply live in his old age. And Congress finally did vote him a pension of $5,000 a year, but he received word from it just about 3 weeks before he died, so he never actually saw any of the money.
Ah. Well, thank you again. Interesting discussion.
All right,
one of the things I ought to say about Sutter, I said he was something of a ne'er-do-well. Yeah, in fact, the reason that Sutter was in California was that he was wanted for tax evasion and theft in his native Switzerland, and he had abandoned his wife and child in Switzerland to go to the United States. He went first to the United States, then he went to Hawaii, then he landed in Mexican California. The irony of it was, of course, he was trying to stay away from his wife and kid. He definitely wanted to leave them behind, and they had no idea where he had gone until newspapers in Switzerland, like newspapers all over Europe, began reporting on the discovery of gold in California on the property of this guy named Sutter, at which point his wife, still his wife, although he hadn't seen her for 20 years, told their elder son to go to California and find your father.
Hmm.
So his fame did him in.
Let's go to our next caller, Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. My husband has an ancestor who went to the gold rush in 52 and kept a diary. And it's really interesting to read the diary and to imagine what things were like for this guy. Apparently people were told how to keep diaries, and even when he was sick and other people kept diaries, what he did was he copied other people's diaries for the time when he was sick. Do you hear me?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I couldn't tell. It sounded totally dead.
Right.
And it's interesting to think about the family he left behind. His wife said, if you leave, I'll be dead. I won't be alive by the time you come back. And I don't know what was wrong, whether she was just guessing this or whether she was sick, but she did die a few months after he left and left three little kids. One of those daughters ended up in an insane asylum eventually. I don't know why, but we have a death certificate from her dying in the Ohio Asylum for the Insane in Columbus. And he also had a father who he ran into on the streets of San Francisco, and nobody had known where the father was. The father had just left his own wife in Illinois, which was where the elder Beers was living, and just walked off one day and didn't even bother to say, I'm going west to the gold rush. And you wonder how many families were affected by people just kind of taking off and heading out and not making sure that their families were well taken care of. Do you have any knowledge about that?
Well, you've hit on some fascinating points. I try to tell the story of the rush to California as much as possible through the individual stories of people who went to California. And one of the most fascinating things is to examine the motives of the people who went. A lot of people went to California. Well, the nominal reason that everybody went to California was to try to make some money. They typically would say to themselves or to their loved ones, I'm going to California for a season or two, and then I'll be back. And the reason I'm going is that I can make as much money in California in 1 year as would take me 10 or 20 years to make at home. And when I come back, we can buy that new house we've always wanted, or we can buy a farm of our own, or I can start up that business that I'd never have the capital to start up by myself. In many cases, they had to leave reluctant spouses at home because typically the wives were left with children maybe, or on their own, and they were going to have to figure out how to get along during the year or two that their husbands were gone. And of course, they had to hope that the husbands would survive the journey, and surviving the journeys that the husbands would decide to come back, because they didn't always. One of the remarkable things about the California Gold Rush is that nearly everybody who left for California went going intending to come back home, because they all saw California's place to make money quick and then come back home. In actual practice, a whole lot of them went to California and did not come home. So they all went to California with a good reason. That is, we're going to make money and I'm going to use it to improve the lot of our family or of the people who are depending on me. But for those people who stayed at home, there was often a great deal of uncertainty. Would they survive? Would they come home? And then, as you point out, they would often run into people in California that they might not have seen or ever expected to see. San Francisco was really a crossroads for the Pacific Basin during the early 1850s. San Francisco was a very large city very quickly. Very large by American standards. There were 50,000, 75,000 people in San Francisco in the early 1850s. It was certainly the largest city on the west coast of North or South America at that time. But it was a city that was quite unusual in that during the first couple of years, almost nobody lived there. They were simply on their way. The ships would land there, and then they would pass a night or two or maybe a week, and then they'd head off to the gold fields. And quite often they would see people that they hadn't expected to see. One other thing that happened was when ships came into San Francisco, their crews immediately would abandon ship and head for the gold fields, with the result that there were hundreds of abandoned ships in the harbor at San Francisco. In fact, I've got a photograph in the book. One of the interesting things about the California Gold Rush was it occurred at the very dawn of the age of photography. So there are photographs of California, of the gold mines, and in this case, of the harbor at San Francisco, where it looks like a forest. But the forest growing out of the harbor is, in fact, these are all the masts of the abandoned ships. Gradually, the city grew out onto, this seems very odd, but it grew out onto these ships, because in the early days, places to live, places to open a store in California, in San Francisco, were very rare and very expensive. And so people would simply start to sleep on these abandoned ships, or they'd open up a store on these abandoned ships. And gradually they would build sidewalks out to the ships, and finally they'd bring in dirt and fill in around them. But even today, occasionally, when people are excavating in San Francisco to build new buildings, they'll run across the timbers of an old ship that was basically filled in to the growing landscape. But all of these individual stories are quite remarkable, and they really vary from one person to the next. Sometimes families were happy to see somebody head off to California. Sometimes they were devastated by it. Sometimes the people came home wealthy. Sometimes they came home poor. Sometimes they didn't come home at all. Sometimes when they did get home, the people they had left behind had abandoned them or had died.
It was interesting, too, to read Isabel Allende's book, Daughter of Fortune.
Mm-hmm.
It's fiction, but it's about Chileans who went to the gold rush.
As a matter of fact, I said earlier that I tell the story of the rush to California through the lives of individuals who went. One of my main characters, a real-life individual, was named Vicente Perez Rosales, who heard the news about the gold rush to California. He was in Santiago, Chile at the time when the news arrived. And off he goes, and I follow him. He takes a ship up the Pacific coast to California, and I trace what happens to him while he's there and how he eventually turns around and decides to go home. But, yeah, and one of my other characters is a shepherd from the outback of Australia, a businessman, essentially, from South China, one of the Chinese who went to California. By 1852, there were about 25,000 Chinese in California. And so I get an unemployed textile worker from Paris, who got swept up in the Paris Revolution of 1848, found himself without a job, heard that there was gold in California, and decides to hop on a ship that sails around Cape Horn and up to California. So these people are coming from all over the world. Gold in California was like a great magnet that just pulled these people in from every inhabited continent on Earth.
One of her points was that people
were more likely to make money if they were providing services than if they were actually looking for gold. And she even, I don't know whether this was true or not, whether she invented it. She has a woman setting up a shipping business to get fresh vegetables up to California from Chile. Do you have any, is that made up or really?
Well, as a matter of fact, very shortly people discovered that California was a great place to grow vegetables. In fact, one of the striking things about California, in contrast to most frontier societies, in contrast to the experience of gradually settling the American West, California began urban. It was an urban frontier and then became rural. Everybody went to California to go dig in the gold fields. But when they went in the gold fields, what it meant was they went to live in what were called mining camps. These camps were small towns of 15,000, 20,000 people. And, of course, San Francisco sprang up overnight as a town of 50,000 people. So we normally think of the frontier of Western settlement as starting out with a few people scattered around a rural countryside, and then cities gradually accreting out of that. In California, the experience was just the opposite. California started out with cities, but then all these people were living in San Francisco and various other communities around California. They discovered they needed something to eat, for example. And so they looked around and they saw that you could grow vegetables and you could grow fruit in the Santa Clara Valley, for example. And so within 20 or 30 years after the discovery of gold, California became increasingly agrarian until by the beginning of the 20th century, 50 years after the discovery of gold, the primary economic activity was agriculture. And of course, agriculture remains until this day the largest industry in California.
Yeah. I hope the caller will forgive me for wanting to go on because I've only got about 5 minutes left and have one more caller I'd like to try to include in Urbana. Let's do that. Line three. Hello.
Well, I just have a couple of quick questions. I was wondering, you were mentioning Mexicans and Chinese and all that. Did they actually get away rich from the California fields, any of them?
Yeah, they did. As a matter of fact, there's an interesting scene in the book where John Fremont is heading west. He had been in California earlier. He was court-martialed. He was hauled back to Washington. He was court-martialed. He goes back out to California. He hasn't heard that there is a gold rush going on yet. And he encounters a bunch of Mexican miners who are going to California. And he asks them, well, what are you doing going to California? They say, well, to mine the gold there. So he forms a partnership with them, and they go and they mine gold on his property. And After about 6 months, a bunch of them decide to go home. And he wants to know why they decided to go home. And they all said, well, we've made as much money as we need, as we'll ever need. So they went home relatively rich. Many of the Chinese went home, although for the Chinese, that was a little more complicated because during certain periods of the mid to late 19th century, it was illegal to leave China. And so you had to sneak out, and then sometimes you'd try to sneak back home. In many cases, they would send money home, even if they didn't go back home themselves. In fact, for many of the foreigners, that was the way they worked out. In fact, that was true for many of the Americans. They would come out, instead of going home themselves, they would send money back home. It was difficult at first when they had to actually ship gold dust wherever it was supposed to go. But within 2 or 3 years, there was a Wells Fargo office, for example, in San Francisco. And people could essentially wire money or send checks, the equivalent of checks in those days. And so that's the way a lot of the money went back home. One of the characters in my book is a guy named Jia Tai from South China, who became quite wealthy. In fact, he got to the point where he employed as many as 100 people, and he decided to stay. So he stayed, and he died in California in the early 1890s. And he made a considerable fortune, definitely by the standards of China in the mid-19th century. Now, by no means were all of them that fortunate. I would say for everybody who went to California, that the people who made more than, say, a year's salary or year's income back home, it was probably less than 10%. But nonetheless, there was always that possibility, and that's what kept drawing people to California.
That's fascinating. Can I ask you one last question?
Yes.
That is that I've always been a little suspicious of the timing here with Mexican War and all. Were there any military excursions prior to the war in the area of Sutter's Mill, secret military excursions, anything like that? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
This would be a great one for conspiracy theorists. But as a matter of fact, no one had any idea that there was gold in California. And when gold was discovered, an American soldier who happened to be there on service in the Mexican War, William Tecumseh Sherman, who would later go on to fame in the American Civil War, was sent from Monterey, where he was based, up into the gold field to find out what was going on. And you can read his diary, you can read the letters that he sent back. And it's quite clear that he had heard about this and he was going to figure out what was going on. But no, there was John Fremont. Fremont was one who lucked into a great fortune. If anybody should have known about gold in California, he should have, because he was a great explorer in the decade before the Mexican War. But he had no idea either. In fact, he didn't have any idea there was gold in California until he ran into these Mexican miners who were heading out there.
We just have a couple of minutes. There's one other thing I want to raise, and of course, not really very much time to discuss it, but we've talked about what this meant for some individuals economically. What does this mean economically for the economy of the United States and actually of the economy of the world?
Well, one of the things it made possible was the establishment of an international gold standard. One of the things that caused the world industrial economy to blossom the way it did in the latter part of the 19th and early part of the 20th centuries was that there was a stable standard of international finance. It was a gold standard. It was sponsored primarily by Britain, but it was adhered to by the United States and other countries as well. This would not have been possible without the discovery of gold in California and subsequent gold discoveries. One of the things I point out in the book is California Gold Rush was the first in a series of gold rushes, because once people discovered what gold geology looked like in California, they began realizing that there would probably be gold deposits elsewhere. So from 1848 until 1898, there were a whole string of gold discoveries. There was more gold dug out of the ground in 25 years after 1848 than had been dug out of the ground in all of world history until then. So this was one thing it made possible, was the establishment of an international gold standard. In more narrowly American terms, one of the things it did was to inject a whole lot of gold into the American economy, but it also inspired the construction of a transcontinental railroad. A railroad was built to California. There was only one reason for building a railroad to California, because there were these 300,000 people there who wouldn't have been there without the discovery of gold. The transcontinental railroad transformed the American economy by creating this continental single economic market, which allowed American industry and the American economy generally to grow in a way that would provide the impetus for people to build bigger, to attain efficiencies of economies of scale, so that by the beginning of the 20th century, the United States had the most powerful industrial economy in the world. This wouldn't have happened without the discovery of gold in California.
Yeah. Well, it's a great story, and it's a fascinating book, and I appreciate very much you taking some time and talking with us about it.
My pleasure, David.
Our guest, H.W. Brands, he's professor of history at Texas A&M University at College Station. And if you're interested in reading about the history of the California Gold Rush, you should look for his book, which is titled The Age of Gold, The California Gold Rush and the New American Dream. It's now available in a paperback edition. It's published by Anchor Books. So you can head out to the bookstore and to take a look at it. And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. The show was first broadcast on December 17th. There are many interviews on the archive if you'd like to go back and catch up on something you might have missed. Of course, also programs there from the Afternoon Magazine. In fact, all of our local production is there, available for you to listen to anytime you like. Go to our website. It's will.uiuc.edu. Coming up in the next part of Focus 580, we will bring back to the show our family practice doctor. His name is Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. And every other month, he is here on the program, and we do a show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. The idea is that anything that might be on your mind concerning your health, could be for yourself, could be for a family member, call in and talk with the doctor. He deals with people of all ages in his practice, adults and kids. So whatever questions you might have, I know he'll do his best to give you an answer, give you a place to start. That will be in the next part of Focus 580. Let me tell you a little bit about tomorrow on the show. In the first part, we'll be talking about the future of graduate education. And our guest will be Maresi Narad. She's director of the Center for Innovation and Research in Graduate Education. This is at the University of Washington. She's also associate dean of the graduate school there. We'll talk about some of the research that takes a look at how well people who have gotten PhDs, particularly in the humanities, have done in terms of their careers and whether or not they've been able to find work, in the line of work in which they were educated. That's in the first part of the show. She's going to be here visiting on the campus to talk about this very subject at a symposium that's going on. She's the keynote speaker. And then in the second part of the show, we'll talk with writer Peter Biskin. He's written a lot about film, and his most recent book is titled Down and Dirty Pictures, Miramax, Sundance, and the Rise of Independent Film, which looks at how it is that the rise to prominence of the Sundance Film Festival and the Miramax Film Studio, what those things did for what we call independent film. That is tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. Coming up a little bit later today on the Afternoon Magazine, a look back at events that resulted in the emigration of 200 slaves from Mississippi to Liberia. There, they tried to replicate the society of the American South of the 19th century. Celeste Quinn talks with journalist Alan Huffman. Following the 1 o'clock news, he's author of the book Mississippi in Africa, The Saga of the Slaves of Prospect Hill Plantation and their legacy in Liberia today. And he makes the argument in the book, in fact, that if you are to understand present-day Liberia, you have to understand this piece of its history and connection to our own. Celeste Quinn is the host. It's the Afternoon Magazine. Show gets underway at noon, and then you can hear that interview in the 1 o'clock part of the show. Coming up here in just a few minutes, we'll have our update on the markets and news, and then at a little bit past the top of the hour, Dr. Jeff Swearingen will be here to answer your questions.
Many doctors are prescribing testosterone for men they believe are suffering from andropause, the male equivalent of menopause, and patients say it works.
Before I started taking testosterone, I was depressed. I didn't want to do things.
But the FDA isn't convinced.
I don't know what the treatment is treating. I don't know if andropause really exists at all.
Male menopause, today on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 Central on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming the Moscow State Radio Orchestra and Chorus for a Tchaikovsky gala, including operatic excerpts and the 1812 Overture on February 19th, and the Tokyo String Quartet performing music of Schubert and Dvorak with pianist Ian Hobson as their special guest on March 3rd. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
Our program, Focus 580, made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great